All right, so we are in one of the coolest parts of the entire Bible. It's often overlooked, but it's, I think, one of the coolest parts of the Bible. Now, as in keeping with our, you know, normal practice here, I'm expecting that you've already read the material ahead of time, so you have at least a working knowledge of the content here. So, obviously, you know, I'm all for it, and I mean, I picked it, so I should probably like it, right? But what stands out to you here about chapter 12, Samuel's farewell speech? What are some outstanding features? Yes. Yep, absolutely. There's an interesting thing there. Does anybody have a note on chapter 12, obviously, verse 5. Does anybody have a translation note there? The Masoretic text, so let me, I'll just pause right here and I'll give a little bit of background. So if you look at any New Testament, right, if you look at your New Testament Bible, what you have, your translation, any translation, is made from what's called a critical text. And I think I've talked about this before, but it bears repeating. So a critical text is a whole bunch of scholars get together, they look at the material, they take as many manuscripts as they can, and they try to, and manuscripts are graded by genealogy, by class, by age, and all sorts of different technical things. And what they do is they come up with a critical text. And that is what those scholars think is the closest they can get with the current state of the art, with the available manuscripts, with the knowledge they have, the closest they can get to what the original wording was. So that's a critical text. Now, I have a bunch of critical texts in my of the Greek New Testament in my office. I've got the Old Westcott and Hort was one. A lot of people don't talk about it, but the King James Version, if you ever meet a King James onlyist, right, people that are like all King James only, like, first of all, I'm sorry that you had to meet somebody like that. But what they do is they talk about how the King James Version is based upon the Textus Receptus. There is no such document. The Textus Receptus was a critical text made by a Dutch humanist named Desiderius Erasmus. Erasmus was a Catholic humanist scholar who looked at the best manuscripts he could, and he came up with a new translation based upon the available texts. The King James Version was based on Erasmus's work, which, by the way, Erasmus's work was not as good as one that came out a little bit later by, I think, either some French or Spanish scholars. There was a publishing war. Erasmus wanted to get his out first, and he won, and his became the most famous version, but his was not the best. And he had to actually guess at some things. Like, there were whole portions of Revelation that he did not have a Greek text for, so he took the Latin text, he took Jerome's Vulgate, translated that back into Greek, and then translated the Greek back out again. So Erasmus's text is the Textus Receptus, but there is no such text. There is no manuscript in the world that reads like Erasmus's Greek. Now, does that mean it's bad? No, it's not bad. Erasmus was a wonderful scholar. He was doing the best he could at the time with the available data and the scholarship that he had. The text, people ask me all the time, they're like, what's your opinion on the King James Version? I say, it is the single best English version of the Bible that came out in 1611, bar none. Like that. But we've advanced, right? We have better manuscripts. We have more of them. We have better scholarship that has been done in the past 409 years. So that's how the New Testament works. So every New Testament document, in fact, the most up-to-date Bible out there is the 2011 NIV. That uses the most up-to-date critical text, at least among your major translations. The Old Testament is different. The Old Testament uses what's called the Masoretic text, and it's published, it's called the Biblia Hebraica Stuttgartensia is what most people work with. It's called the BHS. And so most people are translating from this. This is not a critical text. This is one Bible that is out there, and there's no version, there's no emendations, there's no corrections. Nobody's out there saying, let's come up with the best Hebrew Bible we can. They don't do that. What they do is they take the Masoretic text, this Hebrew text, and where they think that it's wrong and where they just like know that it's wrong, They just make footnotes, and then you have to go back and read what the corrections are, whether they're good variations or bad variations, and then they tell you what the variations are. Anyways, I'll keep moving. There's a place here on that verse, I'm getting back to your point, Dan. On that verse, there's an alternate, the Masoretic text does not say, the Lord said, and the people said, it says right here at the end of verse 5, Samuel said, the Lord is witness against you, and also his anointed witness this day, that you have not found anything in my hand. Now the NIV and all the other texts say, he is witness, they said, or the people said, he is a witness, referring to the Lord. The Masoretic text says, he said, witness. Well, who's he? Is the Lord thundering from the heavens, or is this Saul who's standing there? Samuel is speaking for the Lord, saying, Yahweh is the witness against you. And Saul is saying, I am a witness against you. I talked to some of my Hebrew nerd friends, and none of them could give me a good answer, except one of them who's a much better Hebrew scholar than me. He said that this probably makes more sense for this to be Saul speaking. But anyways, that's neither here nor there. So that only took 5 minutes of your life you'll never get back. So anyways, other things that you find outstanding features of this text. Yeah, that's a really good point. It certainly takes center place in the narrative here, what you're saying. Samuel confronts the people. He says, look, this is the history. He gives them a brief overview of the judges. And he said, when you've rebelled, God has sent foreign armies to oppress you. He's given you into their hand. And when you've cried out to Yahweh, he sent a deliverer. And Samuel mentions himself. He says, I was one of these deliverers. If you remember, we didn't cover it in our study, but if you go back to chapter 6, chapter 7, I'm sorry. Samuel was with the Israelites. The ark has been returned. The Philistines have returned the ark, and the Israelites have gathered together, and they tell Samuel, they said, We are willing to submit ourselves back under the Lord's lordship. And Samuel says, that's a good idea. You should do that. And they all agree. And he's saying, will you bind yourself with this covenant? And they say, we will bind ourselves with the covenant. And then what happens is amazing. The Philistines see this huge gathering of Israelites, and the Philistines decide to attack. The people freak out. And Samuel tells them, don't be afraid, let's fight. And they fight, and they beat back the Philistines all the way to some town, I forget which. And then this is where the famous Ebenezer comes from. Because at the place where they had stopped, where the battle had stopped, and they had come, Samuel says, thus far the Lord has helped us. To this point, the Lord has been with us, is what he's saying. So they set up an Ebenezer. Even is rock. Ezer is I remember, or he remembers. So Ebenezer, we remember that to this point the Lord has been with us. And so these people, this generation of people, they knew that within Samuel's lifetime they had seen what God had done. They had seen that God had been able to deliver them from enemy hands, even when they were in the worst strategic position possible. So they should have known that if they had fulfilled the covenant like they said they were going to, and if they had trusted in the Lord like they said they were going to, and like had been demonstrated to them, worked, everything would have been fine. Exactly what you're saying, brother. But they didn't. And this is, I mentioned on the sermon Sunday that I was going to get to this. Samuel gets to the real reason why they wanted a king. What's the real reason they wanted a king? Everybody always gives the wrong answer to this one. If the Sunday school answer is because they wanted to be like all the other nations. That's a good answer, but Samuel gives a much more specific answer. Why did they want a king? What do you think, Betty? Mm-hmm. That's the reason the Israelites give. And that's part of the answer. I shouldn't say it's a bad answer. That's part of the answer. But there's more to that answer. Go ahead, Jim. That's true. I didn't mention that. That's true. Yeah. Okay, that's true and that's false also, right? And I'm not trying to like pick apart your answer, because you're absolutely right. There was nobody identified to take up the mantle of Samuel to be the prophet of the nation, because his sons were failures. Which, by the way, This is the irony, right? What do the Israelites want? What is their solution to the political military problems that they're having? What do they want to establish? A kingdom, right? Who takes over after the king dies? His sons. What have we seen twice in a row has happened with leadership in Israel? Yes! Eli's kids were turds. Samuel's kids are scoundrels. And the people say, ha-ha, the solution to bad leadership is to create a dynastic position. Oh, wait, no. But they want to. And maybe that goes back because, well, other nations have this. I mean, it's not like they're calling a constitutional convention. You know, this isn't Runnymede, you know, where they're getting the nobles to come together and create some kind of English constitutional monarchy. No, they're saying we want a king like all the other nations have. What kind of kings did the other nations have? They had oriental despots, people with absolute control over life and death, with no one to say boo one way or the other. The king could do whatever he wanted. That's a bad deal. Don't make that deal. Like, don't make that deal. But they want it. There's one pressing reason why they want it. Samuel gives it to us, and we overlook it. I read through Samuel, I don't know how many times before I finally caught this. It's easy to miss. It's easy to miss because it's so obvious, I guess. I'll put it that way. That's true. That's another answer, I guess. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, God says it back in chapter 8, right? But right here, it was right when Ned was reading. I won't punish anybody anymore. So he says, but when you saw Nahash the Ammonite, then you cried out, give us a king, like all the other nations have. They weren't content with a deliverer. They weren't content with crying out to God and having God send a judge, like Samuel was a judge. They wanted a king. Now, all the other answers people have given, those are correct. Those are all part and parcel. Multiple things can be true at the same time. But the motivating factor was there was another external oppressor. This time it was Nahash the Ammonite. Now, Saul and Samuel goes with Saul to fight Nahash the Ammonite, at least so we it's implied in the text. And there's nothing about it in chapters 8 through 11 that was the motivating factor. In fact, when they ask for a king, we haven't heard anything about Nahash. We don't hear about Nahash until chapter 11, when out of the blue he comes up. But Samuel is saying, no, this was actually the reason you wanted a king. Now, why does that happen? Why is the story told that way? I mean, the writer of Samuel could have told us that this guy had arisen whose name was Nahash the Ammonite. Nahash the Ammonite was oppressing the people, and they were afraid of him, and so they wanted a king, a military leader who could unite the tribes and defend the Israelites against him. Because that's what they want, right? They want political unity. They don't want separate tribes anymore. Why doesn't the author of 1 Samuel tell the story that way? This is a hard question. I know it's a hard question. It's an impossible question because we have to guess. But why do we not have revealed to us that the motivation was Nahash until chapter 12, until after Saul has already defeated him? You look like you're thinking, Dan. Well, okay. Just for sake of time, I'll throw out my theory. And if you guys think it's a stupid theory, just say, it's a stupid theory. In the sermon, I said, what's really strange is that we know Samuel's a bad king, and that's hard for us, or Saul is a bad king. It's hard for us, when we're studying it, to read it how it's written, because we already know the ending, right? I mean, it's a spoiler, right? Like, you have the ending spoiled, you know, like in M. Night Shyamalan, if you've seen it once, you've seen it once. I mean, you can't go back and watch, you know, movies with a twist because it really doesn't make any sense. Well, this is kind of a twist. Now, we know that Samuel thinks that having a king is a bad thing, but God is like, no, give him a king. Tell him what the king will do, but give him a king. And then we see the king, and we, because we've read the Bible many times, we're thinking, oh, Saul's a bad guy. Like, everything he does is bad. But that's not really how he's presented. He's presented as tall, handsome, able, humble. Like, I mean, there are some hints there that maybe he's not all he's cracked up to be, but simply by his actions, he's humble, he defeats the enemies of Israel, and then when he has the opportunity to defeat his political enemies, he shows them grace and kindness and says, let's have a festival to the Lord. Like, he seems like a pretty good guy. It seems, in fact, Like Samuel's a chump. Because Samuel said, you don't want a king. A king will be bad for you. And what does the king do? The very first thing he does is wonderful. He unites the entire nation. He defeats this big looming enemy who's trying to defy Israel and insult them. And then he shows grace and kindness. He seems like a pretty good dude. But then we get chapter 12. And we find out that their motivation was all wrong. And then in chapter 13, we're going to find out that the king wasn't so great. That's going to be Sunday. We're going to see two times in a row where we find out Saul is really bad, actually. Saul was not a great king. And so what the author is trying to do is he's trying to slowly take us from this gleamy, glorious-eyed vision of Saul, where Saul is this great dude. And then we slowly pick apart his character and we find out he wasn't good. He wasn't a good king. And the people, their motivations to have a king were really bad. They weren't trusting the Lord. They wanted a king because of Nahash the Ammonite. But Samuel, in his own lifetime, had defeated the Philistines. So, anyways, that's kind of a longish answer, and you can do with it what you want. But, anyways, what else? What else stands out to you? What else makes you really like this passage? Or what else do you not like in this passage? If there's something you think is bad or dumb, you know, let's talk about those things, too. There's two ways to read the Bible, and I was just watching a documentary this morning, and they were explaining it. There's two ways to read the Bible when you read, especially the dumb things people do, and the one is to say, man, those people were dumb. Good thing I'm not that way. Or to say, wow, that was dumb. I need to beware because I'm probably like that too, because human nature hasn't changed, and I can make foolish decisions, and that's, I mean, it's good when we see these things, because then we ask, you know, well, how do I walk away from the Lord? How do I turn away and look for satisfaction apart from Christ immediately after God has done something great in my life? Because it happens. It happens to everyone. We all do this. And the wonderful thing about the Bible, which is the same wonderful thing that great literature does, because the Bible is great literature, is it points out to us the foolishness of folly. That's what the Proverbs are for, right? Like to teach the foolishness of folly and the wisdom of wisdom, right? Like we see how stupid it is to do these things. And then hopefully we learn from them and say, gosh, I don't want to be stupid. It results in bad things. You know, it costs me too much to be stupid and to be foolish. Let me be wise. So, yeah, absolutely. Great point, Gene. That's almost always in the Bible a good answer. Like when you're talking about people, it's like, how could they be so dumb? Like, well, because they are and they were and we are. So, yeah. Other things that stand out to us about the text, things that we find really interesting. Yeah. No, that's a great point. I think you talk about that too, and I something that's worth mentioning, and I don't know that I want to spend the rest of the night talking about it. But does anybody find it odd that the house of Eli is brought down because Eli fails to control his sons? And it's mentioned once about Samuel, maybe twice, but there's no curse on the house of Samuel. Like, Samuel seemingly gets a pass for it. So how is it that one guy has rebellious kids and God looks at him and says, that's your fault, buddy? And another person has rebellious kids, and it's like, he did what he could. You know, he's still a great dude. Does that reflect reality? Just nodding your head, yeah. Can you expand on that, please? Oh, so you're talking, Gene, you're talking about people giving somebody a pass, whether they should get one or not. Okay. I'm thinking about actual, like, moral culpability. Like, is it possible that some people have rebellious kids who actually did everything they could for their kids and they still rebel? And some people have rebellious kids because they were just crappy parents. Just, yeah. Yeah. Boy, it's so hard to tell which, isn't it, sometimes? Because you're never in, well, you're not never in somebody else's house, but, you know, you don't live with other people, and it's really hard to tell. There was A person I really loved, Pastor Rick, who died, he had some kids go, when his kids were younger, they kind of went wild. And Rick was a good man, and he was a good father. And he had somebody who pretty strongly rebuked him. And this other person had a lot of kids. And Rick said, "You know, you might be right. This might be entirely my fault. But life is long, and you've got a lot of kids. And time will tell how they turn out." You know, not that he wanted his other kids to rebel, but it's like, you know, people in glass houses, there's some kind of proverb about that, you know, like, and the thing is there are some people who are really bad parents who inexplicably have good kids. Like, they do everything wrong and their kids turn out wonderful, and you're like, how does that happen? Like, you know, is the proverb true that God protects idiots, you know, like drunks and idiots? Isn't that the, I'm all about proverbs tonight, I guess, but, you know, there's so much, and I know this isn't directly related, but I'll mention it. But, you know, when I was a kid, the kids that were smelly, the smelly kids, they were just smelly. Like, it was just like, dude, take a shower. Like, what's the matter with you? And, you know, after being with Youth for Christ and getting a lot of training and now talking to a lot of people in the social work field, it's like, yeah, there are some kids with bad hygiene, but anymore, like, when I meet a kid with really bad hygiene, the first thing I think is, so who molested them and how long ago was it? Because extreme bad hygiene is almost always related to sexual exploitation of some kind. And is it more common now, or are we more aware of it now? I don't know. But what else stands out to us? Jim, I'm waiting for you. I know you got something here. And you've got to have one in this particular text. I know you have. So a friend of mine was a missionary in West Africa. I can't tell you what country he was in. I know what country he was in. I can't say what country he was in. And he said that they were there, and it was hot because it's West Africa. And he sees the sky just goes black. And he told the other people, he said, "Finally, some rain." And they laughed at him and said, "Stupid white man. There's no rain. Look, the sky is black. It is going to rain." They said, "It's not going to rain." Why? It was the dry season. It doesn't rain in the dry season. It doesn't matter how black the clouds are. It doesn't rain in the dry season. Israel has, it's not like up here, like, you know, in our zone where you get rain kind of whenever. You get rain in January. You know, you get rain in harvest. Now, you can kind of predict, you know, that later in October, there's probably going to be a lot of rain. You know that in May and March and maybe even early June, there's going to be a lot of rain. But you kind of expect that in July and August and parts of September, you're not going to get as much rain. In Israel, it doesn't rain in the dry season. And that's the remarkable thing. Samuel says, "Isn't it now the harvest?" And now there's a terrific thunderstorm. Now, I don't know about you guys, but Samuel has told them repeatedly, "Don't ask for a king. Don't ask for a king. A king will be a bad thing for you to ask for. Don't do it." And God says, "Give him a king." And they come back and they say, "We want a king." And he says, "Let me tell you all the things that the king is going to do to you." And they're bad. And he tells them all the things that the king are going to do to them. And the people say, "Nope, we still want a king." He gives them a king. And he says, "Let me show you what a bad thing you did when you asked for a king." And he calls down rain when it never rains. I mean, I don't know about you, but like, if I'm going to pick my friends, I'm going to pick the guy who can stand before the entire nation and call down rain in the dry season. I'm on his team, right? Like, I don't know if this is Red Rover or what this is. I don't know if we're going odds or evens, but just I want to be on his side. And the people respond, like the people recognize that, oh dear. Yeah, okay, yeah. We did something bad. But then, what does Samuel say? thanks for the flip-flop, Sam. Like, you could have prevented scaring the living crud out of everybody, but don't be afraid. What's that? Probably global warming. Probably. They were burning a lot of something back then, I guess. And Samuel's words are really interesting here at the end. Because asking for a king hasn't really changed anything for the people. At least as far as their relationship to God goes. But now there's a difference. See, before, God would respond to the nation based upon the behavior of the nation. Now you've got another card in play. Now you've got another piece on the board. Because now, not only does the behavior of the nation matter, now the behavior of the king matters. And there's a great question. It's a very good biblical question. And I've never gotten a satisfactory answer from anybody. So if you guys, I would love to hear you guys' thoughts. I really would, because I could really be swayed either way. Do bad kings turn a nation bad, or do bad nations turn good kings bad? Can a good king make a bad nation good? Can a good nation make a bad king good? Who's leading whom here? I don't know that the answer is in from the Bible. I don't know that I would say that people are by nature good. I think that people are by nature bad. You mean like people who are actually following God want to do good? Or okay. So maybe that's a bigger conversation than we can have right this second. But Josiah is a fascinating example that you picked. Because he's one of the really difficult ones. Because Samuel does lead the nation in a revival. And Jeremiah begins his prophetic ministry during the lifetime of Josiah. But as soon as Josiah is dead, the nation goes to pot again. So Dr. McGee asks, how thorough really was the spiritual reformation of Israel while Josiah was king? And he doesn't believe it was. He thinks that it was Josiah and a handful of righteous people who were protecting the whole nation, because everybody else, their hearts had been sold to worship the Baals and the Asherahs. But Josiah is a great example, because could he have effected reform over a long enough period of time? Hezekiah seems to have. It seems like there was a real revival under Hezekiah. It wasn't that long lasting, because both of his sons turned out to be turds. Well, his son and his grandson. And then Josiah, one of those things, Josiah inexplicably turns out to be a great king. No reason for that at all. Like, he did not have good leadership. His grandpa was Manasseh. His father was Ammon. I guess it's a good thing that his dad was murdered when Josiah was 8, because if he had been stuck around his dad, maybe he would have turned out badly. But anyways, I'm taking us far afield, so I apologize. There's one question I want to ask, and that we haven't gotten to tonight, that I think is really important. Why is this even in the Bible? Let me ask this. This is maybe a simpler way. This is a way to get to that question. This is called Samuel's farewell speech. Almost everybody calls it Samuel's farewell speech. Is this Samuel's farewell from ministry? No. Look at chapters 13, 15, the anointing of David. Samuel continues to minister. He continues to be a judge. But we presume that he continues to serve in some function at the tabernacle. Why is it his farewell speech? Does this story actually advance the plot? Okay. Pay attention to what? I think you're right. I think that's a really good point. I agree. I mean, if we're looking at what the plot is of 1 Samuel, if we take the conventional approach that 1 Samuel is about taking us from the judges to the Davidic dynasty, this adds nothing to the story. This does not advance the plot. Now, I'm not saying that I don't like it. I've told you this is one of my favorite parts of the Bible. But this really doesn't need to be here. So if there's a reason that it's here, it's something other than a direct plot advancement. This isn't just here to move us closer and closer to David. I think Gene is absolutely right. This tells us to beware, and it tells us to beware of right and wrong, but I think it does so in a very specific way. And this is the way that I don't think the English Bibles convey very well. Does anybody know what the name Saul means? What the name Saul means? It means he asks, or he is asked. The name of the king that they ask for is named Ask For. They ask for a guy named Ask. And there are endless puns, well, not endless, there are like six. There are endless puns in Samuel about his name. Because Saul, when he should ask the Lord, he doesn't. And Samuel rebukes him for not asking the Lord. And here, all throughout chapter 12, how does Samuel keep referring to the king? He says, the king you asked for. The king you asked for. The king you asked for. And then, at the very end, in verse 25, and then the king, make sure I'm not wrong here. Pretty sure when I was reading through, and nope, it's not in verse 25, but it's right there towards the end. He says, the king you asked for, you guys will be carried away. And then the first word of chapter 13 is Saul, is asked for. What is God trying to tell us? You shouldn't ask for a king. You shouldn't have asked for a king. You shouldn't have asked for a king. You shouldn't have asked for a king. Here's the guy you asked for. Gene's right. God's trying to warn us. What's he trying to warn us of? Yeah, exactly. Be careful what you wish for. You just might get it. Beware of what you ask for. Again, you can probably get that just reading the English text, if you read very carefully. But the fact that it's a pun in Hebrew means that you can't miss it. Like, you asked for this guy. You asked for the guy named Ask For. And you got him. You got him, baby girl. What you gonna do with him? And then what's the very first thing we have after Samuel rebukes them for Ask For? What does Ask For do? He goes and fights, and Samuel has to rebuke him. Because he doesn't do what he says. In fact, what does he do? He takes on the role of the priesthood. He doesn't wait for Samuel. He offers those sacrifices himself. Saul does wrong. The very first thing we have after this confrontation, Saul does wrong. And Samuel says in verse 13, You have acted foolishly, Samuel said. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him leader of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command. See, there's something very interesting, and I'm giving away the punchline of Sunday's sermon here. Saul's the guy they asked for. Saul's exactly the kind of guy they wanted. He was from Benjamin, so he didn't have the might of Judah or the wealth and population of Ephraim and the northern tribes behind him. He was small. Benjamin's in the middle of the country. He was tall. He was handsome. He was brave. Whatever else you say about Saul, he was brave. David's lament speaks very highly of Saul. He was a brave man, and Saul did a lot of good for Israel. Like, let's not pretend that everything he did was bad. He did a lot of good for the nation of Israel. He was the king the nation wanted, the big, strong, handsome leader who couldn't be bought, who wouldn't just push one tribe over the other. He's the perfect king in human terms. Saul really is the perfect king in human terms. He's the one Israel asks for. God says, I'm going to give you one that you don't ask for. I'm going to give you a different king. I'm going to give you the one that I want, not the one that you want. Anyways, well, now you don't even have to come to church on Sunday. Does anybody have any anybody have any final thoughts here? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was getting at, and it's a strange thing because there are these weird transition periods in the Bible where, you know, I'm a dispensationalist, so I believe in dispensations. If you want to talk about what that is, talk to me afterwards. We can have a great time talking about that. But there are these changes in history when God is doing new and different things, and sometimes that segue period is kind of fuzzy. Because now we have a king, but you still have a judge. So what do you do with the judge when you've got a king? I don't know. Like, what does he do? Because he's not really a prophet in the sense that the later prophets will be, the capital P prophets. He's a lowercase p prophet. In fact, the word Navi, I don't think, is ever used to refer to Saul. The word is seer. Roe, I think, is used for Saul exclusively, not Navi. So what do we do in these transition periods? It's hard to sort that out. Good point. Anybody else have any final thoughts? Alrighty, well, I'm going to say that that's all I've got, and if you want to talk about stuff afterwards, I'm happy to talk. So, thank you, guys. Thank you for a fun one. They're all fun. At least I have fun.